Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Barry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, innovative and local public radio for San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from that oasis of thought, we migrate to the air via this oasis of radio. And from the radio, we migrate to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Go check it out.
So, Ken, today our topic is friendship. And I have a preliminary question for you. I've got friends who are philosophers, and I've got friends who are problems, but that doesn't make friendship a philosophical problem. I mean, what's the big deal about friendship? You just like some people, you don't like some people. That's what friendship's all about.
Well, I think friendship is a little more weighty than you're suggesting there. First of all, you know, Aristotle said, and I think rightly, that friendship is essential, is an essential ingredient of a well-lived, well-functioning, flourishing, virtuous human life. Without friends, you couldn't exercise virtue, he seemed to think. But think about this. Friendships are sources of obligations. You owe things to your friends. I mean, how can a mere choice relationship generate obligations? That's a puzzle. And secondly, how far do those obligations extend? I mean, suppose the demands of friendship conflict with the demands of impartial morality. Which would you side with, impartial morality or friendship?
Well, Ken, once again, you've taken my simple-minded attitude towards life and shown that it's fraught with unrecognized philosophical problems. So I agree with you. We're going to have an interesting program about friendship. But I'm not sure about everything you said or everything Aristotle said. I mean, why is having friends part of the good life? I mean, a lot of Eastern religions say that the best life is to go up on a mountain and not have any friends, just you and the flow of being. And as a matter of fact, didn't Aristotle say that the best form of life was pure thought thinking about itself?
Yeah, he said something like that. No, you're right. I mean, there's some complexities there. Friendship may not be the highest good, but it's certainly a good, and especially if you're not living a life of pure contemplation, but living as one human being among others in a polis, as Aristotle would say, in a political society. And surrounded by others and living the life of action, then, you know, it's a very important thing, even if there might be something higher.
Well, another thing puzzles me about friendship. I mean, to me, friendship is something that was incredibly easy. I started having friends before I even went to school. Lots of friendships are formed in kindergarten or when kids are very little. Now, how can this multi-complicated, multifaceted, philosophically fraught with problems relationship just crop up between kids in kindergarten? It seems like they ought to put a little more thought into it than they're capable of.
Yeah, it's not clear they know what they're getting into when they start to form friendships on the playground, eh? Yeah, but you know what? To help us answer that question, we'll turn to our roving philosophical reporter, Ruijin Shen, who went out and examined friendship in preschool. She files this report.
They're really hard to get off leads because they have to.
Who are your first friends? Could they have been your buddies who helped feed silkworms with you in preschool?
A silkworm on your ear.
Yeah, silly, huh? It really seems to happen as they find stuff of similar interest.
Erwin Vista teaches at Mustard Seed Preschool in Berkeley. He's seen children become friends as they take care of silkworms together.
I mean, just the fact that they're together, they're looking at the silkworms, they're playing with the silkworms and handling it together, it just brings them closer together, not only just physically, but then suddenly there's even a mental connection of just what they're doing together. And then later on it just develops further. Then sometimes they'll just randomly talk about their lives at home, and then they'll just have little conversations more about that. And suddenly it's like, oh, I want to come over to your house, and can you come over to my house? So.
Kathy Squires, director of the preschool, has worked with kids for more than 20 years. She says they're aware of each other very early, even before they can talk.
Even in infant care, people notice that even though they aren't playing together, they have become aware of each other. When one child cries, you know, other children will cry too. So they're aware of other people quite early on.
Children at this preschool are from 18 months to 5 years old. Of course, teachers don't tell them what Aristotle said about friendship. Instead, they adopt a more laissez-faire approach.
First, we try to have children become aware of their own feelings. Slowly, then they can be led to be aware of the other person's feelings and interests. Slowly, they are able to be a friend as well as receive gestures of friendship.
I'm playing in the pink section with Colleen.
Her philosophy seems to work well in the classroom. Children play in different sections marked by colors. The pink section is a mini house, blue, reading area, green, blocks. They move from section to section, group, split, and regroup. What happens when a disagreement breaks out?
We try to get them to figure out how to resolve it, so a lot of times we'll just sort of like mediate.
Kristen Madarazzo co-teaches the class.
You know, a lot of times we'll be like, you need to tell so-and-so what you're feeling and why you're so mad. And then so-and-so, you need to tell them back. So if it's like a hurt feeling thing, they'll usually talk and then someone will say they're sorry. They're actually really good about resolving their own conflicts if you let them. They come up with much more creative solutions to how to deal with conflicts. You just need to encourage them to talk about it. And once they start talking, it's fine and they figure it out.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Ru Jingshen.
Thanks, Rujin. Rujin Shen, our philosophical reporter, talking to children and their teachers about friendship. I'm John Perry. With me is my friend, Ken Taylor.
And we're going to be joined by a true friend of Philosophy Talk. That's Martha Nussbaum. She's a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. She's author of many things. Recently, Upheavals of Thought, The Intelligence of the Emotions. Martha, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, Ken and John. It's really good to be back.
Hi, Martha. It's great to have you back. Let me start off with this question. Ken's been explaining to me how Aristotle and other ancient philosophers regarded the concept of friendship as deeply important, philosophically central to ethics and the good life. But the modern philosophers, the one I'm more familiar with, don't say all that much about friendship. It doesn't seem to be a central player in debates about ethics and the good life these days. What happened to the concept of friendship? Give us a little a nutshell history of philosophy and this concept, would you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I puzzled over this as a graduate student because my thesis advisor didn't even want us writing about that part of Aristotle. That was thought to be a kind of embarrassing, old-fashioned thing that wasn't really philosophy. And I think it's because philosophy then was so focused around issues of impartial obligation, what we have duties to do, and the whole issue of what we care about, who we love, all of that was seen as just part of life, but not really part of philosophy. But actually, Aristotle devotes more space to friendship than to any other single topic. Like one-fifth of the whole book is on that topic.
Well,
and I think it's important. I mean, I think there's good reason for that, because I think it is a key. In his view, it was a key to all kinds of other things in the good life.
Okay, so you think it's kind of a loss for modern philosophy that they stop being seized as much as the ancients were with this topic. But okay, so let's dig in. What is friendship? I mean, John said at some point, you know, friends are people you enjoy spending time with. That seems like a kind of friendship, but is that it?
Okay, well, of course, first of all, Aristotle's idea of what he called philia includes family relationships and also romantic relationships, which we wouldn't necessarily call friendship. So it's a very broad concept. But in it, I think you saw in those kids who were wonderful three of the things that he thought of as most important. First of all, sharing the things you care about with somebody. I mean, so you're active, but you want to share the things you care about with someone else. And then second, you are able to understand something about your own feelings and what you do care about much better when you are interchanging them with somebody else. You can see something about your own insides that you wouldn't see if you were all by yourself. And then, you know, finally, this leads to a whole picture of the world where you can, as Aristotle puts it, benefit somebody for their own sake. In other words, you can see the world as a place where it's not just me, 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 but there are actually others there who count for a lot, and you can then think of yourself as going into the world trying to treat them as goals, not just as tools that you use for yourself.
So friends are people, so let's see if I get that was a lot there. That friends are people who you care about not a, and they care about things that you care about things in common. That was one thing you said, right? You care
right,
about things
share,
in common.
And you share activities. So you don't just have the same ideas, but you actually do things together.
And you kind of care about them kind of like, as Kant would say, as an end in themselves. You care about them.
Yeah.
You care about things for their sake. You know, Kant said we should care about humanity as an end in itself. We should care about everybody as an end in itself. Why should I single out some particular person to care about in this particular way? Do people like deserve to be our friends, or what?
Well, I suppose if you're trying to explain Kant to someone and what it was to treat someone as an end in themselves, you might be able to say, well, consider how you treat your friends, right? You don't just treat them as means. And at least if you're talking to a normal person, that would be helpful, I would think.
I think if you don't get to know somebody very deeply, you can't really understand what it is to benefit them for their own sake. I mean, you can obey all the rules in society, but if you don't understand what somebody's life is really aiming for, then how can you really help them as ends for their own sake? And you can't get to know yourself either in a relationship that's very distant.
No, I have to say, I mean, I have lots of good friends. Some I admire, some I tolerate. Some whose company I enjoy, some whose company I think I ought to enjoy, you know, if you know what I mean. But I mean, I have a good friend who's a Republican.
Oh my God,
a right-leaning Republican. I mean, we're good friends, but I'm not at all a Republican. If I were to go to a Republican rally with this person, I would be like, no way, no. You know, so we have conflicting aims there. But she's still my friend. She's actually a good friend. I mean,
Aristotle thought there were different bases for friendship, and some were just that you enjoy the person, just pleasure. Another basis might be that you're engaged in some shared enterprise that's mutually profitable. I mean, that doesn't mean you're just making profit from the person, but if you're a business colleague and you like the person, still the whole context of that relationship is that you're in business together. But then there are the other ones where you really share deeper goals, the things that make your life meaningful, and Aristotle thought those were the best, and I think I definitely agree with him.
Well, and there's all sorts of dimensions of agreement and disagreement. It's easier for me to understand what makes people tick. It's easier to understand what makes some people tick that really have quite different political views in mind than it sometimes is to understand what makes people tick who have very similar views to mine. There's such a gap between a person's fundamental values and what ends up being their politics, it seems to me, that it's not a very good guide.
Oh, sure. That's true. I mean, my daughter's politics are completely different from mine, and I think probably she wants to differentiate herself from me. But that doesn't mean that we don't share a lot in common and enjoy each other's company and have, you know, we might have the same goal of making a more just world. It's just that we have different ways of pursuing that.
Yeah, the same goes for me and my oldest son.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is friendship. Our guest is Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago.
We've been exploring ancient and modern philosophical understandings of the concept of friendship. Coming up, we'll begin talking about the ethical significance of friendship. What do you think you owe your friends, or your friends owe you? Give us a call, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Friendship, ethics, and your calls when Philosophy Talk continues.
The Beatles with a little help from my friends. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing friendship. What is a true friend? What do friends owe each other? Do we have special duties to our friends that we have to no one else? Join us. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Outside the Bay Area, you don't just have to shout. You can call us toll-free at 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.com. .org.
Our guest is Martha Nussbaum. So, Martha, I want to ask you about, I said we owe things to our friends, morally significant things. At least we owe things to our closest and dearest friends. I'm not sure about the people we hang out for mere pleasure. But first question, do you agree about that? Do we owe special things to our friends? And secondly, why do we owe them? I mean, where do these obligations come from?
I do, and I guess it's hard to say where they come from. I think it comes from the very nature of the relationship, and what is if we agree it's valuable, then we have to be willing to give what's important to sustain it. And I think the first thing is time. I mean, the most common complaint is, you just don't have time for me. And, you know, we all have that problem. We work so hard, and we don't have time for very many people. But the Greeks had the problem, too, long before the working world took over. Yeah, and keeping secrets. I mean, that's something we don't owe to everyone in the world. And even in law, you know, a husband and wife do not have to testify one against the other. And that's because, I guess, our legal system thinks that whole relationship, marriage, depends on those kinds of secrets. Now, they don't think that about friends, or probably there wouldn't be any convictions in mafia-related crimes and so on. But they do. We do still have obligations to keep secrets. We have obligations to take care of people when they're sick.
You know, go back to the thing about time. You know, in ancient times, when people mostly engaged in face-to-face interactions with one another and they didn't move around all that much, you could see how a notion of friendship might be kind of an essential glue that holds people together. I mean, there's family, but there's the fellow citizens, but there's also the people that you just are friends with, and you're close to them, and you spend time with them. In the modern age, that's a pretty hard thing to do. I mean, people moving here, people moving there, as the Temptations once said. You know, I mean, people are far flung; they don't even live close to their families anymore.
I want to take issue with that a little bit, because in the ancient world, it took so long to get from one place to another.
Yeah, that's what
really
I was.
We're separated
say.
For a long time. I mean, think about one of the great friendships in the ancient world, Cicero and his friend Atticus, who wrote hundreds of letters, but that was because for about 3/4 of the time they were apart for one reason or another. And John Adams and Abigail Adams, moving letters of a marriage where he was off doing the nation's business in France and whatever, and he couldn't get back in 5 hours or 6 hours the way we can.
Do you suppose that whole genre of thoughtful letters between friends or lovers is going to disappear from our life? I mean, is anybody going to write a book about the email from, you know, Hillary to Bill or something like that? It just seems kind of sad in a way. Letters are thoughtful in a way that emails aren't.
Yep.
So
I think it is sad.
And with respect to time, too, I mean, when we think about Aristotle and Plato, those guys probably had a lot of time on their hands. They were kind of the upper crust. Did the average ancient have much time? Didn't they work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day? Who would have time for friends unless it was the guy sitting on the galley next to you rowing? So I think friendship's in pretty good shape. I mean, at least the conditions of friendship seems to me as good as they've ever been.
See, and then there's this. Two of my closest friends are in India, and I only see them when either they're here or I'm there. But when I am there, I am entirely at their disposal. I don't have any students knocking on my door. I don't have papers to grade. You know, I'm there for them in a way that I would never be if they lived here all the time, because then I just get so overburdened with things that I want to shut that door, you know. And so maybe it's the reason that they're my best friends is because I'm more open to them when I'm in India.
Let me follow up with a question that ties with something you said earlier, and ties into this business of ethics and friendship. Now, you take somebody like Hume. Hume was obviously a very affable guy, had lots of friends, including Boswell, who he didn't see eye to eye with on everything. And I think he wrote an essay on friendship. It doesn't come to mind right away. But in his philosophy, the ethical attitude is one of the kind of ideal observer, as I understand it. That is, ideally, you would go and seek the judgment of someone who didn't have any friends involved in the melee. He would have these kind of general feelings of benevolence towards the people, and then he would approve of what some did and disapprove of what others did, but you wouldn't take friendship into account. That makes I wonder if there's more of a conflict between friendship and ethics than the idea that you should do something special for your friends. Don't you have to go out of your way not to do something special for your friends?
Well, I think that's the central issue of the ethical life, as far as I'm concerned, that we do have obligations to make sure that people everywhere get a decent life. And so what do we do about that when we think that we want to also spend extra time and maybe extra money for our friends and our family? Now, in a single nation, you could kind of imagine how to solve that. Namely, if you ever had a just tax system, then the tax assessor would just take from you what is owed for the welfare of everyone, and what is left to you, you could use for your friends and your family. But in this country, we don't have that, and in the world, we sure don't have that, and we probably never will have a world state that does that. I don't even think we should. So what do we? How do we decide this? And I think it's just a constant conversation we have to have with ourselves.
So if you follow out Hume, you get to someone like Peter Singer, right? That, you know, kind of a utilitarian who believes that in making judgments about what's right and what's wrong and what you should do and what you shouldn't do, you really shouldn't take physical closeness and friendship much into account. And there is something very strange and non-human about that.
I think you have a point. But I do think, though, that there is a question about when there's a conflict between the demands of morality and the demands of friendship. But I still want to think a little bit harder about just how these demands of friendship are generated before we can consider how morality overrides them. But we have a caller in the line who wants to say something about our responsibility to our friends. That's Carol. Carol in Menlo Park, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. I feel that that friends actually give you kind of a moral responsibility to help check their outrageous behavior. And I think often you kind of do a mental thing in yourself when you think about performing or doing something that might be outrageous or out of bounds, and you think, how would your friends think about it? And I think that it's kind of that you have a responsibility to your friends to keep them in the bounds of respectable behavior.
Thanks, Carol. Martha, what do you think about that?
Well, I guess I think this is tough. I mean, if they're your kids, I think that's one kind of friend, and that's one kind of obligation. But as we're talking about adult friends, then I think we have to be very careful not to just boss people around and treat them as extensions of ourselves. So, yeah, while of course friends can correct each other and criticize each other, I think, you know, respect for the person's freedom has to be centrally in there. And there are certainly ways of keeping friends in bounds that don't respect their freedom.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. You can reach us at 415-841-4134 or by email at philosophytalk.org. And we've got an email here that's kind of interesting. I don't know if, Martha, you're so caught up in evolution, but Ken will probably really get a kick out of this. He says, the topic of friendship probably can't be complete without some mention of evolutionary theory, from flat-out physical defense to acting as a wingman when a buddy tags along in the attempt to meet physical mates, potential mates, to many other possible scenarios. It isn't very hard to tell a plausible story about the assistance of friends towards passing along one's genes. So is friendship one of these genetic leftovers? Does that affect its moral or philosophical status?
You ever thought about that, Martha?
Oh, I don't. I'd rather hear what Ken has to say about it.
Well, you know, I think that human beings are coalition-forming creatures, right? So it's no accident that these children on the playground that we heard about are in the business of forming coalitions, friendships, you know? And human beings, I think Aristotle's deeply right about something. Human beings thrive through engaging in cooperative activity. And I think he's right about something else. Human beings morally flourish by having another human being be a mirror to you, mirror yourself to yourself, and having deep concern for you. I think that's all right and good, and I think we're designed to be like that. So what do you think, Martha?
I think you can see this in other species, too. I mean, they used to think that all non-human species were fundamentally selfish, but Franz de Waal, who's done these wonderful studies of chimps and bonobos, wrote a book called Good Natured, which says, look, in these species too, there is sympathy and there is treating the other one as an end, not just a means. And so we can see that as part of our evolutionary heritage, but we can also value it when we see it. And I'm sure you can see this in dogs all the time. I think it's also present in elephants, one of my favorite animals, who really do mourn when an elephant dies. I mean, they show a real capacity for valuing the individual and grieving.
If you're a friend of Philosophy Talk and you want to join this conversation, give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you happen to be listening from afar, 1-800-525-9917. And Dave in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Dave, you there?
Ooh, I think we lost Dave.
I think we lost Dave there. John, you were gonna say
something. Yeah, I was gonna say, you know, when you think about the evolutionary origins of friendship, pretty much, you know, the activities that we think of as comprising friendship are pretty obligatory for the people in the same group you're in, whether it's a family or a clan. Then there's a big step that people take. One thinks of Romeo and Juliet. Of course, that was romantic, but still the two people from the different clans find that they have a bond of friendship, in this case, romantic friendship. It seems like there's a big step there, and that's one of the things that seems to me available in the modern age. It really, through the internet, you can form all these interest groups. You can meet people that you have, in a sense, very little in common with in terms of needing to protect the same turf, economic interests, local interests, but you really do share these kind of higher intellectual or political or literary interests. And so friendship is a rather interesting development from these evolutionary bonds, if that's really where it comes from.
But I want to say that I think it would be good to think about friendships between men and women, because for a long time, and this was something philosophers did talk about, it was just assumed that their lives were so different and in such different spheres that there could be passion, there could be even something like love, but there couldn't be friendship between men and women, because after all, the woman just doesn't know about the things that the man cares about. Although it was assumed that he knew enough about what she cared about to boss her around in the household and so on. But, you know, now we don't think that way. We think that even though there might be originally some historically differentiation of spheres, men and women can really share activities. And one of the greatest, my favorite philosophers, John Stuart Mill, thought about this a lot, because he was one of the first who really had a marriage that was that kind of a friendship, and he cultivated it over a long period of time and thought it was absolutely essential to human well-being.
Yeah, well, there's a problem, though. I mean, since men and women are also potentially erotic partners with one another, and friendship is a form of intimacy, I mean, there's that always, can the man and a woman be, as it were, mere friends? You know, there is that.
I mean, now we know that men and women and women, it's the same thing. We just like to deny it so the locker room feels comfortable. But look here, when you undress in the locker room of your gym, you know that there are people around there who are looking at you with erotic interest.
I try not to think those
destroy
thoughts.
Friendship.
I try not to think those thoughts. Peter in San Francisco.
Men are always that way.
Yeah, Peter in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Peter.
Hello.
Are you there?
Yeah.
What's your comment or question?
Well, regarding what friends owe each other, you were earlier, you know, talking about what friends owe each other. I don't know if I would think of it as owing anything to my friends, but I do believe that I feel moved to have empathy for them and try to think in a given situation, what is it, how do they see their situation? What is it I could do that would help them more than, you know, what would I do for myself, but actually think of what would help them, try to put myself in their shoes, and that makes me think of empathy. And then one of your people on your program mentioned the word sympathy, and I think of those two words a lot and wonder what the difference is, because, I don't know, sympathy seems nice, but sometimes if it's taken too far, I don't know, sympathy is one of those slippery concepts, you know. I tend to go for empathy more. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the difference between sympathy and empathy.
Thanks for your call, Peter. Martha, I'm going to put that question this way. I mean, we are empathetic, or sympathetic, whichever, to our friends. I'm not sure it makes a huge difference here. But you know, here's this. Friendship is a kind of partial relationship. I have it to some people, but not to all. Do my friends deserve my sympathy more than other people deserve it?
Well, I want to first answer his question about the words. I mean, people use these words in different ways, but I think it's important to recognize that empathy, that is the ability to put yourself in the other person's shoes, is not enough for the attitude that makes a friend, because you could be a very good torturer, and that being a good torturer requires empathy, namely understanding what that person finds humiliating and painful, right? So sympathy, I think, goes further, and it combines the imaginative ability with a kind of well-wishing and wishing for the good of that person. And so I think we need that.
So on your understanding, sympathy implies, this is interesting, I'm learning something here, sympathy implies empathy. Empathy is the ability to put yourself in the other person's position, but that may or may not make you sympathetic to them.
That's quite right.
Okay.
And sympathy, compassion, I kind of, people use those interchangeably.
I have sympathy for my friends.
Okay.
Do they deserve that sympathy more than the other people deserve it?
Well, I think, you know, a life in which you had equal sympathy for everyone would end up being a very dense life, because it's through having a kind of deeper sympathy for a few people that you learn how to treat anyone. There's some very good psychological research on troubled teenage boys done by Dan Kindlin and Michael Thompson that talks about how when these boys just play sports together and they don't cultivate this imaginative sympathy for so they don't really have friends, they just have people they play sports with, then they don't really know how to treat anyone, because their whole imaginative faculties have been stunted. And so they just go out into the world with all this aggression, and they don't really understand when somebody's feeling fear or pain and so on. So they just act as though they are the whole world. So I guess I think even if what we wanted was a world of impartial morality, we would need to get it through cultivating these closer relationships.
I
also think they're good in themselves.
We got an email here that's kind of interesting. I think it connects with empathy and sympathy. Hi guys, Sean says, often people say that they are friends with their pets or refer to the pets as their furry friends. How can we be friends with pets since human lives and the lives of, say, cats are so different? Well, of course, cats are one thing and dogs are another. I'm very fond of my dog, but we don't share many, if any, aims in life. So is this just a metaphor, being friends with your pet, or is it this, some people seem to think, the deepest and purest friendships they have?
We have a colleague like that.
First of all, it's an alternative to saying that you own them. And, you know, lots of people, of course, we do technically own our pets, but people don't like to think of that as the core of the relationship. It's like that would make it like a form of slavery. But I think it's possible to be friends with certain kinds of animals. Sure, there are animals that are capable of empathy, and there are lots of studies on that. Chimps, all the higher primates, but also dogs are very capable of empathy. They even understand when someone's deceiving them. They can get into somebody's mind that much that they can understand lying and deception. So I think, you know, cats are different because although very intelligent, they don't really care what you think and they just go their own way. So I'm not sure you can be friends with a cat.
I've heard it said that the difference between dogs and cats is that dogs have masters and cats have staff.
Yeah,
and I think there's something to that.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing friendship with a true friend of Philosophy Talk. That's Martha Nussbaum.
We've been talking about what friends owe each other and why they owe it. In a moment, we'll confront the challenges to friendship in modern society. Has the new technology made it easier or harder to form and keep friendships?
More of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Bette Midler and friends. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing friendship with Martha Nussbaum. How has modern technology impacted your ability to make friends? Give us a call. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
If you're outside the Bay Area, don't worry. You can call toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us, comments@philosophytalk, all one word, .org.
Martha, I know you're a great cosmopolitan. You've written, forcefully and eloquently on the subject. So I want to ask you a question about this. You talk about the importance of friends, but again, that's a partial thing. And then there's this impartial caring for humanity. Suppose the demands of friendship conflicted with the demands of impartial justice or something like that, impartial morality. Help me think about how to resolve those conflicts.
Well, it's the problem, right? And I try to think about, you know, in terms of what I write about, I do certain things that I think might be helpful to people when I write about social justice. And then sometimes I just want to write a book about Mahler or something that's completely self-indulgent. And I just try to juggle those two things all the time. But of course, there are other ways to support humanity with your money, with other kinds of concern, like teaching students that it's important, like raising children who think it's important. So, you know, it's not just a question of how to spend your writing time or your professional time, but it's a constant balancing act. I mean, should I give my child a college education when I could use that same money to save 100 kids from starvation on the other side of the world? And that's a real thing. Well, I think yes, because without a college education, she's really doomed in the American system. But what about a fancy car? Probably not, I would think.
But you don't think it's just a... But you don't... I mean, some cosmopolitans would think of the whatever obligations friendship and kind of particular relations to particular people generate would think that those are kind of second-grade things. They're always overridden by the considerations of impartial justice. It doesn't sound like you think that. It sounds like you think they're weighty. They have a weight of their own that can't be...
I think they have a weight of their own. Now, I also think that it would be... The best setup, as I said earlier, you know, would be if we had institutions that told us what we have to do to make sure everyone has a shot at a decent life. Because I actually think it wouldn't be that expensive to make sure that world hunger is eliminated. I mean, there have been studies not done on this. And in fact, the military budget is vastly in excess of what it would take to end world hunger and world poverty. So we could do it if we had a way of figuring out how to do it institutionally. And I think, you know, if we don't have a world state, then what should probably happen in the short run is that every single country should give something like 2% of GDP to end problems of world poverty. And that would be taken out of everyone's pocket in some suitably fair way.
I kind of get the general picture. Robin in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Robin.
Well, thank you. You've brought up psychology and public policy, and I was wondering how that fits, the findings of psychology recently fit in with a philosophy of public policy of what should, what are humans like. And it looks like from recent researches that friendship is sort of often the basis of successful therapeutic relationships, and also is a required element in the thriving of and development of young children. So that would suggest it has a part of the evolution of humans is being friendly. And is there a way of integrating that into public policy?
Well, thanks for that question. Richard in Cupertino is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Richard. What's your question? Richard's gone. We're losing Jay in San Francisco. You there, Jay?
I'm taking my call. I would like to recap on the brief discussion on utilitarianism we had a little bit earlier, and how it seemed that utilitarian was discredited and friendships weren't allowed. However, looking at it from a most happiness for the most number of people, could friendship not fit very well into that, and saying that friendship does provide a lot of happiness and is part of the ultimate end as well?
Thanks, Richard. So, Martha, you got two questions. One about psychology and human thriving, and one trying to defend a utilitarian conception.
Well, let me just interject, since I was the one who said utilitarianism and friendship seemed to go in opposite ways. But still, the utilitarians I've known have all been excellent friends, people like Jack Smart, great friend. And so there's one more thing for your soup, for your mixture to for you to digest, Martha.
Yeah. Well, about the psychology, I was glad he brought that up, because I think for a long time in public policy, we've operated with this idea of economic man, that people are all fundamentally selfish and everyone's trying to advance their own individual well-being. Well, psychology has thrown that out the window in the way that the caller suggested, focusing on friendship, but also by just showing that actually people are altruistic and they do make choices that benefit others for their own sake. So there's this whole new field, behavioral economics, now that builds on the kind of behavior that we know people have. And so it's important. Philosophers have been criticizing these economists for many years, but now we have the psychologists on our side, so that's a good thing. But as to the utilitarians, see, I think you're quite right that there are many sophisticated ways that you could defend these special relationships. Mm-hmm. And of course, people like Sidgwick and Mill, they did that. But in the end, you've got to be prepared to give it up if, in a particular case, it's not promoting the general well-being. And so the question is, could it really be friendship if It's kind of provisional like that, so that, you know, you do the calculus, you run it all through, and you find, well, you know, in this instance, taking care of my friend really doesn't serve the universal well-being, so I got to drop my friend today. I think that's not really friendship. I mean, I think you can't give it the kind of weight that it really needs to have. And of course, you're right that utilitarians are very good friends, and they, Sidgwick certainly thought a lot about that. And I don't know, you know, whether they can make their lives fully consistent. I think Mill really basically owned up to the fact that you had to throw out the simpler forms of utilitarianism in order to do justice to
Martha,
friendship.
We have one last caller. Evie's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Evie from Berkeley.
Thank you, and it's a marvelous topic. Thank you for covering it. I'm interested in personal friendships, the equality that is shared. The friendship can be an enduring one over a long period of time with lots of sharing, and then when the situation changes, say, between two friends, if one is suddenly divorced or widowed or something like that, if it's in the case of maybe two women, then the person who was kind of the lesser person in the friendship suddenly both are now equal. They're both, you know, on their own or single or whatever, and that that the equality or the level of equality seems to be very important in the friendship, that one may have to be stronger than the other or feel that they're more powerful
Evie,
than the other in a friendship. So how do you keep a friendship from dying?
Evie, thanks for the question. Martha, you got time for a brief response to that one.
Okay, I think that when the inequality is so great that you really want to say, I can't choose to leave, then it can't be a friendship any longer. It's a problem with sexual relationships, too, where there's an asymmetry of power. That's what sexual harassment law is about. You know, if there's not that real freedom to say no without a penalty, then it's just not any good anymore. So, but, you know, there are lots of changes that aren't like that.
So thanks for joining us, Martha. It's been a real pleasure having you.
Yeah, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks a lot, Martha.
Our
guest has been Martha Nussbaum, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago, author of many, many things, and most recently, Upheavals of Thought, The Intelligence of the Emotions.
And we also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to and some very interesting emails that came in that I'm afraid we didn't get a chance to get to.
So, John, really briefly, you have any last insight, really briefly?
Oh, last insight. You were right. Friendship is full of philosophical problems and issues. As usual, you were right.
And on that concession, I'll tell you, this conversation continues at our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blog. I think, therefore, I blog. Go check it out.
John, I've got a terrible headache. My head is just pounding like crazy. There's like 100 horses in there.
Ken, that's not your head pounding. That's not 100 horses. That's the phone ringing. It's the conundrum time. Somebody's got a problem they want us to help them with.
Oh, and we have a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Hi.
So where are you calling from?
San Francisco.
What do you do over in San Francisco, Paul?
I teach community college and do online course development.
Wow. What do you teach in community college?
Philosophy.
We usually try to exclude the philosophers. Here,
we got a ringer.
Yeah, we got a ringer. Tell us about your conundrum, Paul.
Here's my conundrum. Is it right to arrest or imprison someone for a crime that he or she has yet to commit? This issue is different from the issue of intent to commit a crime, because intent to commit a crime is itself a crime. On the contrary, what I'm talking about are situations in which no crime has been committed, not even the intent to commit a crime, but law enforcement claims that someone must be arrested or imprisoned because if not, then he or she will commit.
Wait a minute, Paul. How is anybody supposed to know that Smith over there will commit a crime?
Let me give a hypothetical example and see if that helps clear things up a bit. So imagine a giant database containing all sorts of facts about people. And imagine that this database indicates that, say, 95% of people who, you know, whatever, buy orange juice at the grocery store on Tuesday at noon have committed murder. And imagine that on the basis of this statistical correlation, everyone who buys orange juice at the grocery store on Tuesday at noon is arrested or imprisoned on the grounds that there is a 95% probability that they will commit murder.
Wait a minute. I got a quick answer for you. No.
The analogy that sort of came to my mind is a medical analogy. You know, if you go to the doctor and the doctor says that you have a gangrenous leg that needs to be amputated, and if you don't amputate it, then, you know, there's a certain probability that you'll die. You know, in that case, you know, someone would be willing to say, well, of course, you know, you'd follow this expert's advice, you'd get the amputation and save your life. And that, you know, something similar must apply in criminal situation of, you know, we have these experts who have access to this data about people, and if they say that, you know, this person is a threat, then just like we would believe in, you know, the doctor who's an expert, then we should believe, you know, the law enforcement person.
But wait a minute. The reasoning is too quick here.
There's another example that's timely, I think, and that is we do actually in a number of states now preemptively imprison sex offenders. We don't do it on the basis of statistics before they've committed any crime. We do it after they've committed a crime or two. But then the feeling is that if they're not cured, even if their term is up, they can be kept in confinement. I mean, they can sincerely believe and have the intention to be good, and yet if their psychiatrist is convinced, yeah, they're sincere and they have that intent, but it's not going to last for long and they're going to go out and harm someone, then they're detained. Now,
Here's another kind of case.
Is that legitimate?
Here's another. I don't know. It's good. We're supposed to be solving this, but let's multiply the cases for a little bit and see what they have in common or what they fail to have in common. And you can weigh in here, Paul, whenever you want, since it's your conundrum. A young white woman in Harlem sees a young black guy at night alone and decides to cross the street. Now, the young black guy takes offense and says, "What do you think I am? A mugger, a rapist?" And the young white woman thinks to herself, "That guy might well be a mugger or rapist, because look where I am, look where these kind of crimes statistically happen." Do we blame the young white woman for that?
Well, my tendency would be not to blame the young white woman for that. There is a problem in that all knowledge, as we know from Hume, or at least I think we know from Hume, comes from what we might, to put a negative spin on it, call stereotyping, right? We look at the past, we look at patterns, and we form our future expectations around those patterns. Now, there's no doubt that what we call racial stereotyping is connected with this habit, which is part of rationality. So the young woman, if she really has had that experience or read those statistics, I think may be reasonable for her to go across the street. On the other hand, I don't think she has any right to imprison him or punish him on the basis of statistics. There seems to be quite a gap between
the
two.
That's true. So there are different kinds of cases here. Why don't we change your example to involve a person of Middle Eastern descent who looks a certain way, and we say, there is a certain probability of a person like that being a terrorist. We don't want to be subjected to terrorists, so we're going to preemptively detain him. You know, a lot of people might say, yeah, go ahead, do that, bully. Your point seems to be, that's a pretty bad form of reasoning, because by the same token, by what we philosophers like to call parity of reasoning, you would say the guy who, what was it, buys lemonade on a Tuesday or something, mm-hmm. should be preemptively detained or something like that. My answer to the second one, the lemonade buying guy preemptively detained, is obviously no. My answer to the first one is, I don't know about that. I guess the question would be, is statistical correlation between this feature and that feature? Is that suffice for probable cause? I don't know.
Well, I would have thought that our Bill of Rights prevented people from being preemptively detained, but for more than 48 hours. But given these actual cases of, on the one hand, the sexual offenders, and on the other hand, all these people that were suspected being terrorists, it seems like it doesn't afford quite the protections that would have.
So, Paul, I'm sure we haven't solved your conundrum, but I hope we've given you some more food for thought.
Yeah, I mean, you've definitely offered some variations on the initial conundrum that are interesting.
Thanks a lot, Paul.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at nights, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Rujin Shen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.